From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
Well, in the first part of today's show, we'll speak with Sophie Yeo, author of the new book, Nature's Ghosts, The World We Lost and How to Bring It Back. For millennia, humans have influenced nature's course, leaving lasting marks, both positive and negative, on the environment.
In Nature's Ghost, journalist Sophie Yeo delves into the pre-human landscapes from the megafauna-shaped terrains to post-ice age forests and from the eagle-filled skies of ancient times to flower-adorned farmlands of recent centuries. Through stories of landscape shapers and their imprints, Yeo uncovers forgotten tales seeking ancient wisdom to mend our fractured bond with the earth. That's in the first part of the show.
Then, in the second part of the show, we'll talk to Andy Szabo about Alaska's whales. Szabo is the director of the Alaska Whale Foundation. He'll describe what research the foundation is performing in the face of climate change and break down a recent study that expands the understanding of how humpback whales work together to net fish using bubbles. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us now is Sophie Yeo, who is an environmental journalist and author of Nature's Ghosts, The World We Lost and How to Bring It Back. Welcome, Sophie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, we are going to get into all about what this book entails. But first, I'd like to get more information about you and a little background about your environmental journalism and what led you down this path. How'd you get started in that area?
Yeah, so I've been writing about the environment for more than a decade now. First, I was writing about climate change quite a lot, but then I diversified to write more about biodiversity and the natural world. And that kind of ended up tying in with an interest I'd always had since I was very young in kind of culture and history and how we know about the past. And I realized that there was this unexplored area among journalists, I think, around paleoecology and how the past can impact conservation. And so I started exploring that and speaking to people, and it was that really led to this book.
Yeah, so you kind of explained it there, but tell us a little bit more about Nature's Ghosts and the overarching theme or themes that play throughout.
Sure, it's really about the past and how by looking backwards in time, we can think differently and more sort of smartly, really, about conservation, how we preserve the natural world. In the book, I talk about the past in quite a broad sense. I go back millions of years in some case to explore the impacts of climate change over a vast time scale and how that can inform how we think about climate change in the future. But I also think in much more recent time scales, like in the recent past, the last few centuries, how, for instance, looking at more recent but not really distant agricultural methods, for instance, can improve the sort of farming that is done today.
You do make an argument in the book for the importance of inclusion of rural communities and the conversations around conservation and the actual action in conservation. Why do you think that's important?
I think it's always really important to think about that human angle, because the natural world is not bereft of humans. It hasn't been, you know, humans have been around for hundreds of thousands of years. In that time, we've always been impacting the environment in some ways, sometimes for better, often in more recent times for dramatically worse. But I think that you can't write humans out of that story. You have to give them a voice, and humans have always been part of nature's story. So I thought hard about how to include them, and I hope I've done that in various different ways. You know, I start by looking at the impacts of Neanderthals, for instance, and in more recent times, how farmers in Transylvania kind of imitate some of the natural processes that would have played out there in that region in the deep past.
Can you give us some more examples of how you pull in these rural communities and ways in which they are acting in conservation efforts?
Well, yeah, to go back to the Transylvania instance, the farmers there in Romania, they still farm in a very traditional way, much as they have been doing since medieval times and earlier. And that's really interesting because that's a region. Transylvania is a region that has maintained a lot of its diversity, in particular, a lot of its floral diversity. And if you look at the science on this subject, that's really because the methods that these traditional farmers are using imitates some of the natural processes that would have played out there in the early Holocene. They're kind of acting in some ways as the extinct megafauna that would have kept this region open and given those flowers a chance to thrive across the area. So as those megafauna became extinct, there was a risk they would have been swamped by forests if farming hadn't come along and sort of kept the area open, acting like these grazers. So that's just one example, I think, of how rural communities come into my book.
I wanted to circle back to a term you use, paleoecology. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it's sort of ecology as we know it today, but looking at how natural processes played out in the deep past. And it's not as simple as, you know, today we can observe what's happening in real time before us. But with paleoecology, you have to look at these different proxies to understand how the environment operated, because you just can't tell by looking at it today, because we've removed so many of the jigsaw pieces of the natural world. So, for instance, to understand what forests were like in the deep past, a paleoecologist might look at the pollen record by looking at the pollen that was laid down by those trees at the time, which becomes fossilized. You can know what trees were growing and when, roughly. I mean, it's always an inexact art in a way. Or you might look at the remains of beetles, which can tell you about the landscape at a particular time, because beetles are very associated, closely tied in with certain environments. So a paleoecologist will look at all these different proxies, and it's a science that's developing all the time as a means of understanding what the landscape was like hundreds of thousands or just thousands of years ago.
Can we get a sense of what the planet might look like if we weren't here at this time? You know, would it be, I'm going to guess it would be dramatically different on an ecological scale. Has anyone tried to map that out?
It's a good question. I think it is at the heart of a lot of rewilding efforts in some ways. I think you can never know for certain what it would look like in the absence of humans, because humans have been a part of that system. You could argue they've been a keystone species in the same way that a beaver might be today. But I think you can be certain of some things, like there'd be a lot more disturbance, I think, natural disturbance in the environment. I know in the US, for instance, there's a history of wildfires being suppressed, whereas in the past, they would have been a very natural and dynamic part of that ecosystem. There'd be, without humans, it's highly likely that a lot of the megafauna would still be around, would probably have mammoths wandering our landscapes today. Right. So there have all been all these knock-on effects that humans have had over the years. And I think if you take those away, you'd end up with an environment that was a lot more governed by natural dynamics. You know, there'd be a lot more death, I think, as well, a lot more decay. As today we tidy away all our deadwood, our forests are neat and tidy places, but a natural forest would have a lot more dead wood and old trunks and lightning hit trees littering the ground and standing up, offering a habitat that's been lost in many, many places.
I guess we might be able to poke around areas of maybe Siberia or some stretches of Central Africa or somewhere where humans' footprint, so to speak, is much lighter, and maybe that could give some insight.
Yeah, I think wilderness definitely exists on a spectrum.
Yeah.
I think even in remote places, you do have the impacts of humans evident. And I think also we have to remember that the impacts we have in our, you know, very developed communities, very intense communities, they have knock-on effects in places like Siberia, like, for instance, climate change that is being caused in places like the UK and America. You know, we're largely responsible for that, is impacting Siberia, it's melting the permafrost. So even I think if you go to the world's most remote locations, you can't really take away the global footprint of humanity.
Right.
Yeah. And I want to get back into the title of your book, Nature's Ghosts, The World We Lost and How to Bring Them Back. And you had just said something about rewilding. Can you, from your perspective, give us the definition of that and share some examples of maybe positive actions in this realm of rewilding?
Yeah, I think rewilding is a term that began with quite a specific definition and has been broadened out into it to have quite a popular definition. I think in its most basic sense, or in its most popular sense at least, it means doing any action that means the landscape around you becomes a bit wilder, a bit less tamed. So you can do that in your own garden, for instance. You can let wildflowers grow in your lawn. But I think on the more dramatic end of the scale, it means taking whole landscapes and removing the human influence to a certain extent and allowing natural processes to take shape again. I think probably the most famous example we have in the UK is the NEP estates, where they've reinstated a lot of larger livestock like horses and Tamworth pigs as proxies for some of the species we've lost over the last 1,000 or so years. An example I write about in my book that I think is a really inspiring example is the Carrie Fran Wildwood, which is an effort in the Scottish Borders to reinstate a forest as it would have looked about 6,000 years ago, when we did have these mega natural forests across the vast majority of Britain. So I think it takes different shapes. People interpret it in different ways and they sometimes argue quite heatedly over it. But I think that, yeah, in its most popular sense, it's just taking away some of that control that humans have exercised and allowing nature to take the reins once again.
And clearly, we can't go back in time. And we already are so intertwined as humans. We're moving in tandem with our natural world. So what do you think that path is forward? And what, even from your perspective after going through this and writing this book, what do you see as maybe some positive ways in which we can create a more sustainable world?
Yeah, I definitely agree when you say we can't go back in time. And I think that's something I tried to keep mindful of as I was writing the book. You know, there's no going back to a pristine state. Our impact has been very deep and long lasting. But I think I was trying to show that even if you can't completely create a faithful replica of 6,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago, there are always lessons to be learned from the deep past or just the recent past. So you can learn how to farm more sustainably. You can learn about how climate change might play out, and you can get more accurate models of that. And how extinctions might happen. And that allows you to adapt more effectively and more efficiently. So I think we need to be looking at these lessons that are there in the scientific literature, but perhaps we don't pay attention to enough because we see the past often, or the trying to recreate the past as something dangerously nostalgic or romantic. I think actually it's a very practical way. It's kind of the best blueprint we have for how nature functions in its most basic state, and that shouldn't be ignored.
And when people read your book, what are some of the biggest takeaways that you want them to have? What do you want to maybe sit with them?
I want them to realize that we've become dangerously unambitious in what we're trying to do. I think we often aim for a depleted state. It's this shifting baseline syndrome. And I hope by reading my book and realizing just how magical and ferocious and dynamic and abundant nature was in the past, we can broaden our horizons a bit and try to increase our aspirations to take into account some of that wildness that once was.
It's the nature of quote unquote humans to want to tame that wildness, to want to control it and domesticate it over time and then industrialize it. And as a result, it's to our own peril that we continue down this path.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, humans are already suffering from the impacts of climate change, from the impacts of extinction, from the impacts of you know, things like soil erosion and flooding. Mm. And I think if we heed some of these lessons, we'll be creating a better life for ourselves as well.
Well, it's a big challenge with 8 billion of us running around the planet, Sophie. But, you know, I like your approach, and I like your, you know, the example you use of Transylvania and people living a less impactful life. I go back to the book I read when I was in high school or college by British economist E.F. Schumacher, who wrote the book Small is Beautiful, one of the first books about sustainability from an economist of all people. But that's what he talked about, you know, life in a smaller footprint. But it's a challenge. And hopefully your book provides us a path to show a footprint or a blueprint to help us in that direction.
I hope so. Yeah, I think I was careful not to claim in the book that I was solving every challenge. I don't think it's a book that shows how to feed the world or
right.
how to cope with, you know, population expansion. But I think it's a way of looking at how we approach conservation in certain places where there is that possibility. And there is the possibility in lots of places to create a better environment. And I hope that is what it shows.
Yeah.
Well, we appreciate you, Sophie Yeo, here with us, an environmental journalist who has just penned the book Nature's Ghosts, The World We Lost and How to Bring It Back. Sophie, if people want to get their hands on this book or to learn more about you and your writing, how would they do that?
Probably you can Google me or find me on Twitter. My name is Sophie Yeo, the surname, no one knows how to spell it, spelled Y-E-O. But yeah, just online.
Okay. Yeah, your website is sophieyeo.com, and it's a great way to learn more about your projects, yourself, and this writing. Do you have anything that you are working on currently that we can look forward to?
Not really. I'm actually 6 months pregnant, so I'm mostly tailing off my work in anticipation of a new arrival. But hopefully after that, I will have more things on my plate again.
Well, congratulations. I would say creating a human is a pretty big job. So we are so pleased to have you on our program, This Green Earth. Thank you so much, Sophie.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Joining us for the second part of the show is Andy Szabo. He's the director of the Alaska Whale Foundation, and he's here to talk about all things whales and the foundation and the research they're involved in. Andy, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with Claire and me on This Green Earth.
My pleasure. Nice to meet you too.
Let's start here. Give us a little background on the Alaska Whale Foundation, its mission, goals, objectives, etc.
Of course, yeah. We were founded in 1996, largely to support whale and ocean health research initiatives. About 10 years ago, we created a field station here in Southeast Alaska, and now we operate a team of between 8 and 10 people every year out of this field station, where we're conducting, as I said, a lot of whale and ocean health research initiatives.
So, describe some of that research that's going on. Is it primarily focused on Alaska-based whales?
It is. Most of our work has on humpback whales, which are sort of the main large whales that we find in our area here. And starting in about 2016, we launched what we're calling a whale health campaign. Mm. And essentially what our work is we go out there and every month of every year, and we're mapping out the distribution and the abundance of whales in our study area, which is quite a large area. We are taking all sorts of health metrics. We're using drones to look at body condition. We're collecting biopsy samples to look at reproduction and stress hormone levels. We're taking photo ID so we could recognize individual whales across days, weeks, and years. Essentially, we're going out there, we're giving individual whales a health exam. And we do this, like I said, week to week, month to month, year to year, to track how the population is doing. And while that's going on, we're also collecting a whole lot of oceanographic data so we can monitor how the oceans are doing and how that's impacting the whales.
Ah, yeah, I want to get to that in a little bit. But how many different types of whales are you tracking?
For the most part, we're encountering humpbacks up here. We do get killer whales in our study area, and when we see them, we're certainly collecting data on them as well. Most of those data we'll share with colleagues who are focused specifically on them. We've recently begun a new project looking at gray whales that migrate through our area here in basically March through May. But again, most of the time we're focused on humpback whales.
Which is a very fascinating species, and there's a new study that's come out about how they feed. But first, can we lay some groundwork and foundation about these humpback whales and just how fascinating they are, maybe starting with their socialization and how they hunt and feed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. I think they're one of the most exciting whales for sure to study. One of the things that's really unique about humpback whales is, for one, they have a very diverse behavioral repertoire. They have a whole wide array of foraging tactics that they use, from things like bubble net foraging that we'll talk about, mm-hmm. to any number of different tactics. But they also have this very unique social structure. Most baleen whales are not particularly social, but the humpbacks we have up here in Southeast Alaska form these teams of 12, 14, 16 members. And they'll work together to deploy bubble nets and to use feeding calls to manipulate their prey, and they'll divvy up the roles within these groups. And so they have this very coordinated, choreographed feeding tactic that's really exciting to watch. But again, they also have this very diverse behavior or acoustic repertoire. They're very communicative. So they're just a really exciting animal. Add to that they're coastal, so we can see them readily. It's just a great species to study.
Yeah, and when you say they're very acoustic, I think that's one of the things that people maybe do know about humpback whales, is that they have this, they call it a song or singing, and these songs, I guess, can last up to 15 minutes, but it's mostly the males that do this. Why is this something that they deploy out there into the ocean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are certainly well known for their song. And that is something that only the males, as you said, produce. And by and large, they only produce that on their warm subtropical breeding grounds. And it's associated with mating. So it's usually the males, presumably, are trying to establish territories and or attract females by using that song. And as you said, these songs can last for 15, 20 minutes. And the interesting thing about the song is all the animals within a breeding population, for the most part, are singing the same song at the same time, but that song evolves over time. But here in Alaska, where I work, we don't really hear much song, maybe early in the season when the whales are just coming back from the breeding ground or just before they leave in the fall. But for the most part, there's really no mating activity going on here. So we're not hearing singers, but we are hearing a lot of chatter. As I said, they have this very diverse acoustic repertoire. They're making all sorts of different calls and sounds that almost certainly are being used for communication when they're doing things like coordinating their behaviors in some of these very complex foraging tactics.
So in addition to their chatter, say, there's lots of other noises that are going on in the waters, quite a bit of it perhaps man-made. Is noise pollution, so to speak, in the ocean environment a growing problem?
It certainly seems to be a growing problem. There are a lot more ships in the water now than there used to be, and that seems to be increasing. And there's all sorts of other sources of noise from mining exploration and naval activities. And this is certainly putting a lot of sound into the water. Now, we are somewhat fortunate, comparatively so, up here in Southeast Alaska, in that there's just not nearly the boat traffic, and a lot of these other activities that put sound into the water are not going on. So I would not say that that's really the biggest threat to the whales that we're seeing. Certainly for very acoustically sensitive animals, like toothed whales that echolocate, they have very sensitive hearing. Those are the ones that are most likely to be impacted by human anthropogenic noise in the oceans.
Are humpbacks kind of a keystone species in a sense that give you an idea, like a healthy or the presence of a humpback group is the sign of a healthy environment?
Yeah, we would refer to that as an indicator species.
Indicator?
And it's certainly, Yeah, the health of whales really reflects the health of the ecosystem. And also healthy whale populations are actually important for creating healthy ecosystems. But that is, again, one of the reasons why humpbacks are such a useful species for us to study up here, because if we start detecting changes in their population, any sort of health changes in terms of stress levels or body condition, things like that, things that we can pick up quite quickly, that really points to something that's going on with the underlying ecosystem. That's certainly something we've been seeing over the last 10 years, fluctuations in these populations that are indicating something's going on with the ocean.
Is that something, I'll go there, is it warming water? Is it changing currents? Is it food supply impacts from, say, human activity? I'm sure the answer is yes to all three, but Andy, go ahead and elaborate. Yeah.
Yes, unfortunately it is, yes. And there's no question that warming oceans are impacting these populations. Alaska Whale Foundation, together with a number of our colleagues up here in Alaska and throughout the North Pacific, detected some really striking changes in whale populations that began to happen around 2016, which followed this very significant warm water event called the Blob, or the Pacific Marine Heat Wave. Mm-hmm. And essentially the Gulf of Alaska and the North Pacific more generally was 3 or 4 degrees warmer than average for about 2 years, which was quite unprecedented in terms of the duration and the scale of that event. And that had very clear detrimental impacts on not just whales, but the entire marine ecosystem. But certainly we're now working on a study with our colleagues up at the Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve that are suggesting that there was probably a mass mortality event that happened with these humpback whales, maybe 25% of the population in Alaska was lost due to that warm water event or following that. And we're seeing this sort of these types of effects impacting all sorts of trophic levels throughout these North Pacific marine ecosystems.
And just to follow on, you know, 3 to 4 degrees, Andy, to me and you and Claire, doesn't sound like a tremendous increase in temperature. Oh, 3 to 4 degrees, you know, come on. You can, yeah. But to marine species, that is a life-threatening condition. You say they literally perhaps died from heat exhaustion or so?
No, that's not what seems to be happening. What happens when you have warm water is it stabilizes, because it's almost, warm water is almost like oil on water. It floats to the top and it stabilizes the water column. And what that does ultimately is interfere with the circulation of nutrients up into the surface waters where all the phytoplankton grow. Those are the plants of the sea. And once you have that occurring, you get declines in phytoplankton, and then you have this domino effect or this cascading effect throughout the trophic web. So you have declining zooplankton, and then you have declining fish, and that makes its way all the way through to, in our case, the humpback whales.
So speaking of how they're feeding and how this works, let's get to this new study that you just did where you are finding that these humpback whales are creating what has been termed bubble nets. Describe what that is and what their food intake generally is and how this helps them to bring it in.
Yeah, of course. So bubble netting, which, by the way, has been something that has been described, I think, 1920s was the first description by perhaps some whalers up here in Alaska. So this is something that people have been seeing for a while. But what the animals are doing is they will swim down to depth. In our study, we found they're swimming down to about 20 meters, and they'll start blowing air out of their blowholes as they're swimming along at about a meter and a half a second. That seems to be the speed they're swimming. And as they're doing that, they're swimming in a circular direction. And so those bubbles are forming a curtain or a spiral that start rising up to the surface. And that ultimately creates a cylinder that the animals are able to use to corral. In the case of these solitary whales that we studied, concentrate their prey. So if you think about the krill that the animals are feeding on, those krill may be in relatively low density, so low that it may not be profitable for a whale to take a big old mouthful of that. They're just not gonna get as enough krill as they need. Mm. Keep in mind that krill are tiny shrimp-like crustaceans that are less than an inch long, so a whale needs a lot of those. So if they're not occurring in the densities they need to make it profitable, what appears to happen is they'll start to create these really complex, elaborate bubble nets. And what we found from our study was the bubble nets, the actual structure of the nets, are these sort of nested rings that get smaller and smaller and smaller. And so what we think is happening is the whales are corralling this large area of krill, And then they're condensing them further and further and further into these real small patches that are basically not much larger than the size of the mouth of the whale. Hmm. And so now you have this real high density aggregation of krill that are contained and can't go anywhere because they seem very averse to swimming across those bubble curtains. And the whales are able to just sort of do a slow lunge right through the middle. And what we're estimating is these animals can get maybe 7 times on average as much prey in a bubble net than they would if they weren't using that bubble net. And that essentially means 7 fewer mouthfuls of prey to get the same amount.
Yeah, who's not going to be opposed to that? How many whales does it take, or typically, to create this net?
Well, that was one of the things that was quite notable. We have been studying cooperative bubble net foraging up here in Alaska for 25 years. My colleague Fred Sharp was one of the first people to look at this. And that is a behavior where you'll have 12, 14 whales working together using a bubble net. But in our case, these are solitary whales. These are individual whales who are working by themselves and who are able to deploy this big, large bubble net and target the krill that way. So it's quite interesting to see this comparison. The other thing is we're starting to realize there's quite a difference between the bubble nets used in these sort of cooperative events or cooperative behaviors relative to what we're seeing in these solitary whales. So it seems like these whales are actually able to adjust that tool based upon the social setting or environmental features or the types of prey that they're feeding on, which really suggests a very complex cognition for these animals to be able to think through this and develop different types of tools.
Yeah. How much food do they need to survive in a day or a week?
That's a really good question. And the simple answer seems to always be 500 pounds, which is very convenient. It is quite challenging to address that because we don't really know how much they're able to take in with each mouthful. As you can imagine, you can't be in front of a whale as it's about to lunge. But we can do energetic modeling. And we can look, for example, at how much mass a whale gains over the course of its summer foraging season. And we can use that to estimate the amount of prey. And I've heard some people suggest that maybe as few as 1,000 herring is what a whale would need if they were feeding on herring in a given day. So that roughly translates to somewhere around 500 to 1,000 pounds of food. But even that really depends on the species of prey, which all differ calorically, and the size of those prey, and even the life stage of those prey. For example, a herring that's about to spawn, that's full of eggs, is going to have a lot of calories. Mm. If you feed on that same fish a week later after it's spawned, all those eggs are gone, half the calories. It's like comparing celery and bacon, for example.
And you know, I was just going to say, do you see behavior changes between how males and females do this?
Not that we can see. These behaviors seem to be readily adopted by both males and females. And one of the cool things we see with these cooperative bubble netters up here, males and females work together quite closely and will actually form these sort of enduring bonds that can persist for multiple decades. That's very unusual for mammals. But again, we got to keep in mind that there's such a clear spatial and temporal separation between breeding behavior, which happens in the warm water where males are competing for females, and feeding behavior, which happens up here in Alaska, where actually it pays to work together, both males and females. So again, we don't really see much in the way of differences up here in terms of the two male and female sexes.
We're speaking with Andy Szabo. He's the director of the Alaska Whale Foundation. We're talking about their research and their work up there in Southeast Alaska, and particularly with respect to humpback whales. I'm always fascinated at the evolutionary process that is involved in species developing skills. In effect, skills using tools, you know, in this case, bubbles, to capture prey. I mean, I'm sure that's a tough one to answer, Andy, but any senses of like who was the first whale that said, hey, you know what, I'm going to try this bubble thing, or maybe I did it by mistake and it's like, hey, this really works. I know I'm not being somewhat flip, but there is an evolutionary process to that and passing that behavior on to their young.
Yeah, you touch on a couple things there. For one, we know that humpback whales are the only species that do this.
Oh,
and we think that has to do with, in terms of baleen whales, we think that has to do with morphological features. They have very large pectoral flippers that make them much more maneuverable than, say, a blue whale or a fin whale. Very broad flukes. So again, they can actually create these very tight spirals that, say, a blue whale could not. But within the species, we certainly don't know who was the first whale to do this.
Right.
And almost certainly it's been going on for a long time before we've been observing them. As I said, it was in the 1920s that the whalers first reported this in Alaska. We also know that multiple populations of whales that do not interact, for example, whales down in Antarctica, our colleagues just published a paper of bubble net foraging that they were seeing going on down there. Those populations independently evolved or appeared to independently evolve this behavior. So we know that they can do this. They can figure these things out. And again, there's a whole diverse behavioral repertoire that these animals have, suggesting that they are quite adept at coming up with new strategies. With respect to how it's maintained in the population, individual learning almost certainly is a big part of it. Mm-hmm. But with respect to some of these cooperative ones, almost certainly they're watching each other. Mm-hmm. And they'll be in these groups feeding, and there'll be a bubble blower in there, and one of the whales who's maybe never done it before, and of course I'm speculating a little bit here because we can never be with the whales when this is happening. But I imagine that if that group breaks up for some reason in the day, you're going to have two different groups now, and one of them is not going to have a bubble blower in it. And so presumably one of those whales who was not a bubble blower before thinks, you know what, I'm going to give this a try and see if it works. And if it does and they become successful, then presumably they'll keep doing it. That's how it sort of spreads over time.
How is your observations performed? Are you actually obviously maybe in the water with them, or is there some underwater craft you use? And you mentioned drone technology too, providing valuable insight into their behaviors.
Yeah, we certainly don't get into the water with them. It's often too opaque here anyway. We wouldn't be able to see too much, and the whales are moving too quickly for us to keep up with them. But the two key developments in the last 10 years with respect to understanding underwater and just behavior in general for these animals are, as you said, drones, which give us this aerial perspective so we can see from above what these bubble nets look like when they arrive at the surface. But also the use of these suction cup CATS tags that we've been using. These are football-shaped tags that have four suction cups on them. They literally just stick onto the animal, use a 20-foot pole to pop it on its back. The whale essentially doesn't notice it's there. It pops off benignly after about 4 to 12 hours. But what those tags carry are cameras, hydrophones, temperature sensors, depth sensors, and also these accelerometers that can determine what the three-dimensional position of the animal is underwater. And that allows us to recreate exactly what the animal is doing underwater, what it can see underwater, what it can hear underwater. And it was the combination of those two tools, the tags and the drones, that allowed us to do this or publish this paper, do the research that led to this paper.
Now, you said there was a certain time period that they fall off. Do you ever follow, because they have this crazy long migration, is there ever this tool in which you follow them through this migration?
Mm-hmm. There certainly are tags. There are subdermal tags that individuals will use that will stay on a whale for a month and a half at times. And those can be useful for looking at migration. But by and large, for us, we're actually just matching images of the flukes of the whales. And I mentioned this earlier. If you take a picture of the underside of a tail of a whale, you can recognize an individual whale from that fluke print. It's much like a fingerprint. Mm. So you can create catalogs of flukes of whales that we see, for example, here in Alaska. And then we can compare those to catalogs from our colleagues in places like Hawaii. And it's because of that that we know that 85% of the whales here in Alaska migrate to Hawaii in the winter months, about 15% go to Mexico, all just through that photographic technique.
I see, because each one of their tails is unique to the specific animal itself. That's fascinating.
So circling back to their threats and their overall health, we touched upon climate change and how warming waters are impacting their health and welfare. Do they have conflicts with the local, say, the local fishing industry or cruise ships? We talked about noise pollution too. Touch on that.
Yeah, those are two significant sources of mortality, unfortunately for whales, especially humpback whales, which, as I said, are quite coastal and tend to forage in areas where there's a lot of people. And so Ship strikes, unfortunately, do happen and seem to be happening with increasing regularity. I would say two or three a year reported up here in our population, Southeast Alaska. That varies year to year. And then net entanglements. That's another big threat to these whales. And so, in fact, we're part of a network of responders that's led by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And essentially, there's a whole bunch of individuals that are out there that if we hear of a whale entangled in fishing gear, we'll get notified and we'll go out with a whole series of tools to try and disentangle the animal and also collect data on what the nature of the entanglement is so we could start to think about ways to mitigate this or minimize these types of interactions moving forward.
What is their lifespan normally?
Yeah, we used to think it was maybe 40 to 50 years, but we've kind of increased that as we've had in tools that provide more resolution into how long these animals are living. So we now think that a humpback whale may be as old as 90, a really old humpback whale. Interestingly, bowhead whales in the Arctic, we now know that those whales can live to be 200 years old, which is just remarkable. These are very long-lived animals.
That's incredible.
Yeah, for a living species like that. I mean, we know trees can survive for hundreds and hundreds of years. I was not aware that there's an animal like that, a marine species that can live that long. Is that the longest living marine species that you're aware of?
No, there are sharks, deep water sharks that we know can live to be over 200 years.
Wow.
And I think there's maybe some of these slow developing, long-lived fish like halibut and things like that. But for a mammal, that is very long. 200 years is exceptional for any species, certainly.
And so how do you track that in their body? Because I know in humans, a lot of the times they do it dentally, right, by their teeth, but they don't have specifically teeth that you can. So how would you track that age?
They have these earplugs, basically, waxy earplugs that deposit or accumulate, I should say, layers, much like tree rings. Huh. And so if you had whales that washed up dead on a beach, for example, you could take out that waxy earplug and you could count those rings and estimate that way. Increasingly, we're using molecular techniques where our colleagues have developed molecular clocks that allow us to look at the cells of these animals, the DNA of these animals, and use that to infer how old the animals are.
Just a couple minutes. Are these whales hunted at all by, say, the local natives, indigenous tribes or so, or are they hunted in other parts of the globe?
By and large, humpback whales are not targeted that I'm aware of in any commercial whaling, and I don't think in any indigenous whaling. I could be wrong. Certainly not here in Alaska, mm-hmm. or in Canada, where I'm from, in North America. But there are other species that are. There's subsistence hunts for bowhead whales up in the Arctic that are hunted by indigenous people, certainly in Norway and Iceland and Japan. Other species like minke whales are targeted, but certainly the humpback whales that we study no longer are. They used to be, of course, 100 years ago. There was a lot of whaling here in Southeast Alaska, but there's been a moratorium on whaling for quite some time now.
And obviously that's a good thing. Last minute or so, are you encouraged by what your research is showing with respect to the overall health and welfare of humpbacks and maybe other whale species? In that way, you know, given all the threats that they face, are they adaptable? Or how resilient are they?
You know, I sort of alternate between pessimism and cautious optimism there. The large problems that they are facing really are tied to climate change and warming oceans. And that is a problem that we're going to have to tackle globally. This is not a small scale thing that we, the Alaska Whale Foundation, our colleagues can work on. They do appear to be resilient. These populations have recovered from whaling relatively quickly. And even the impacts of that warm water event that I spoke of, which really impacted things like birth rates and body condition of these whales, they seemed to respond pretty quickly once that heat wave had dissipated a couple of years later, at least.
Right.
And so they are resilient. And the one thing I wanted to point out, too, that we kind of touched on in that paper that we just published, they seem to be very flexible in their behaviors. Humpback whales in particular, as I keep saying, have this very diverse behavioral repertoire. They're tool users. They can use all sorts of different foraging tactics. And I think, I hope that that will serve them well as their ecosystem continues to change under these warming conditions.
And if someone was trying to learn more about this, to get that study or to learn more about your foundation, where would they go?
You can go to AlaskaWhaleFoundation.com, or sorry, .org, .org. And I believe that paper is published, it's freely available, published online. It's an open source paper.
Andy Szabo, director of the Alaska Whale Foundation, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Okay, well, while we have a couple minutes here, there is a challenge that was just set forth. It's the 2024 You Clear the Air Challenge, put out there by the University of Utah, Chris.
That's right.
It is a challenge to all of the students, so you students out there and faculty of the University of Utah. Tell us a little bit about
it. Yeah, what is it about? Well, the 2024 You Clear the Air Challenge is your opportunity, students, administrators, employees of the University of Utah, to make climate-conscious travel choices that will improve the air quality down in Salt Lake City and in and around the campus and contribute to the overall health and wellness of the communities down there. This year's challenge runs from October 1st to November 15th.
So you still have a couple weeks to get involved.
That's right. And it's open to all current University of Utah and U of U Health students, faculty, and staff. The goal is to reduce the number of single occupant vehicle trips you take and replace them with more sustainable ways to travel, such as public transit, cycling, walking, carpooling, or telecommuting. Huh, that's interesting. Okay, so participants who sign up and record the minimum number of trips qualify for a chance to win prizes, including a new e-bike, sports tickets, cycling, and outdoor gear, and more. So how do they sign up, Claire?
Well, all they have to do is go to @theu.utah.edu, or you can also look up, if you just type into your browser, You Clear the Air Challenge, it will come up and you can sign up through there. And they encourage all of their faculty, staff, and students to do this. It is a great way. Again, we always talk about how when we get together and do small things collectively, they do make a difference, but it can also change habits, Chris.
Yeah.
And it can allow you to better understand why this is so important. I think it brings it to light that we obviously have some issues with our air quality in Utah, and it's, you know, a lot of
particularly
people
down
are
there,
taking a stand.
Now that we're coming into the winter season and the potential for atmospheric inversions, et cetera, hey, every tailpipe matters.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the opportunity to participate in kind of a challenge. And, of course, win prizes.
Yes, absolutely. So if you wanted
a
new e-bike, this could be your chance. Like, go for it. So, again, you can go to @theu.utah.edu and search for it there. Or if you just type into your browser, the letter U, Clear the Air Challenge, you can find it through there. So, yeah, I encourage all people to do it. I know there's just a couple weeks left. It did start in October, but hey, it's never too late to start these habits. And, you know, if you do the minimum, it says you'll be entered into those prizes as well. So we hope everybody out there does that.
All right. Perfect.
That's a wrap for this edition This Green Earth. So first, let's thank our guests today. In the first part of the show, we spoke with Sophie Yeo, who is an award-winning environmental journalist, and we talked about her new book, Nature's Ghost, The World We Lost and How to Bring It Back. And actually, Chris, Sophie has been shortlisted for the 2024 Wainwright Prize for writing on conservation for this book,
nice.
Nature's Ghost. So congratulations to her.
Yeah, that's great. And also thanks to our second guest, Andy Szabo. He is the director of the Alaska Whale Foundation. An interesting conversation with him about Alaskan whales and the challenges they face with respect to climate change, etc.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review. And we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars. And you know, we love it when you email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for topics for further stories in the future you'd like us to cover. It's thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.